CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story this hour. The U.S. is reportedly paying out over $800,000 to the families of the 16 Afghan civilians allegedly killed by an American soldier. CNN's Sarah Seidner explains how the payout is being received in Afghanistan.
And in this region, you often hear that in the very beginning, people say, we don't want your blood money. We don't want this. We don't want anything because it can't bring back our loved ones. But in the end, often they do take the money. Now, here is how the U.S. put it, though. They said, look, this isn't compensation, according to our source. This is money that is given to you as help from the U.S. government.
President Obama's three-day trip to South Korea is focusing on nuclear terrorism and how to secure the world's nuclear material. The president also met with his counterpart from South Korea and talked about how North Korea's plan to conduct a missile launch would be a bad idea.
It would only deepen North Korea's isolation, damage further its relations with its neighbors, and seriously undermine the prospects of future negotiations.
President Obama made his first trip to the Korean demilitarized zone. Rick Santorum will pick up at least 8 of Louisiana's 20 delegates in the race for president. He easily won the state's primary Saturday, but still trails Mitt Romney by about a 2-to-1 margin in the overall delegate count. Pope Benedict holds Mass in León, Mexico today. CNN's Rafael Romo says it's the main event of the Pope's trip to Mexico.
This is the first time Pope Benedict XVI visits Latin America, Spanish-speaking Latin America. He was in Brazil in 2007 and then in the United States in 2008.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney is recovering from heart transplant surgery. Cheney has waited more than 20 months for a new heart to become available. The donor remains a mystery. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
Now you can dial a diamond and save half by calling Empire Diamond at 1-800-SAVE-HALF. Over 70 years in the Empire State Building, they'll sell diamonds wholesale without a middleman's markup. That's right, GIA-graded diamonds at half the price of famous high-end jewelers. Qualified buyers may have diamonds into their home or office for a free 10-day no-obligation inspection and get a 60-day money-back guarantee. So save half on your diamonds. Visit at dialadiamond.com or call 1-800-SAVE-HALF. That's 1-800-SAVE-HALF.
Looking for a better way to grow your business? A Regions Cash Core Analysis can help uncover ways to optimize your cash flow and improve your bottom line. It's all part of the Better Business Banking experience we're building just for you. So, if you're ready for a bank with the insight and guidance to help grow your business, switch to Regions. Drop by a branch or visit regions.com/yourbusiness today. Regions, it's time to expect more. Regions Bank, member FDIC.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, DC's one and only and best food and wine variety show.
Join us Sunday, March 25th. We're going to get pickled in studio with Gordy's Pickles. They're local pickle makers. They're going to show us all their wares. And if you're into vegetarian food, we've got the chef for you. Chef Adam Barnett is in from Eventide.
I can't believe you made that pickle joke. Anyway, that's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live right here on 1500 AM.
Hey man, what's up? Angie went to Walmart and got this cool Pioneer HD radio receiver, and now she's like, eh, I don't know.
Simple stuff. Check out the buyer's guide at HDradio.com.
Cool buyer's guide. Oh, here's the Pioneer DEH-44, under $120 at Walmart. Angie, hip and smart.
See, dude, HDradio.com has the answers you need, and Walmart has the Pioneer with built-in HD radio technology you want. Now all you need to do is learn how to talk to girls.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
My advice to you, until they upgrade the system, simply turn off PhotoStream on your iPhone the next time you're in Vegas, and then it doesn't go anywhere.
Okay.
Or else, change your Vegas behavior, or else, don't take pictures while you're in Vegas. So now, once you've deleted all the photos in the PhotoStream, you've got to then go to the camera roll and delete those individuals.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview.
Yeah.
And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association, and this station.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce, and this is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Dixon, from the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Leslie Westheen, the President and CEO of the Personal Care Products Council, Neil Albert, Vice Chairman of the Board for a company called MCR, Rob Williams, Founder and President, Clear Government Solutions, and John Wyatt, Chairman and CEO of Sigital, Inc. Joining us first is a young lady by the name of Leslie Westheen, who's the President and CEO of Personal Care Products Council. What is the Personal Care Products Council, Leslie?
It's a trade association. We represent about 650 companies, in the global cosmetic and personal care industry.
How would we know one of your companies, for example?
Pretty much everyone, all of your listeners, I think, are very familiar. We have an average of your listeners, probably the average number of our products they use a day is, 7 to 10 products. So we represent all of the cosmetic and personal care industry.
How big or small is the organization today?
We represent about 650 companies.
650 companies. And when was the company founded?
It was founded in 1894.
1894. Why?
Well, it's really important back then, as it is today, to bring the industry together, to advocate for the industry, to educate members of Congress, educate our members, educate the consumers about the industry and their issues.
When did you join the firm?
I joined about 4 years ago.
And why were you the perfect pick for this job at the time?
Well, thank you for saying perfect pick. I have a background in the federal government. I worked in the White House. I also worked in the California Governor's Office, which a lot of the issues, a lot of the regulation and laws come from California. And I've spent a lot of time focusing in on advocating for business, for different interests in Washington, D.C. and in the state capitals.
So you've spent your entire career in government service?
Well, I'd say one way or another. I was an attorney. I started as an attorney. I was not a very good one, but I started out as an attorney, and then I did work in the California Governor's Office, and then I started an organization out in Silicon Valley. We ended with about 250 high-tech CEOs and venture capitalists, and then I made my way back to Washington, D.C. To work after the White House, and then I joined this Personal Care Products Council.
What did you do for the White House?
I ran the Office of Public Liaison. It's a great job. I tell everyone it's the best job in the White House, probably including the presidency at some days. It's a job that's focused in on coalition building. It's also focused in on we are the key relationship to all of the constituent groups, and then all of the events. We did about 400 events a year with the president.
And how did you find your way to this position?
My current position, I am thrilled to say that they found me. I was originally in Silicon Valley. When I left Silicon Valley, I was the co-CEO of TechNet.
That's a heck of a departure, Silicon Valley to personal care
it's
products.
It's all about innovation.
Innovation and personal care products.
Right.
Say something
and
else about that.
Exciting products and creating jobs. They're both great, great industries.
You get so excited about this. What makes it exciting to you?
Well, you know, as you started, the conversation, how do we know your products? Everyone knows our products, right? It's a great industry. We create millions of jobs. The industry globally is a $250 billion industry. We're very, very focused in on charity. We have a wonderful foundation, a Look Good, Feel Better Foundation, where we help women who are going through cancer. So it's a wonderful industry.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the early days. What were you like? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Florida, South Florida. With my father was an oral surgeon, and I used to help him in his office, which I would not recommend to anyone, helping an oral surgeon, unless you want to go to medical school. And my mother owned a travel agency, and it was a wonderful upbringing in Florida.
What do you suppose you learned from your dad?
Hard work. He is a wonderful human being, but very, very stingy. And he would never give me one penny. If he ever gave me a dime, he'd say, no, no, this will weaken you as a person. I'm thinking, no, it will weaken me. So he was stingy, but it really was all about hard work.
Uh-huh. And your mom?
My mom was a dreamer, you know, owned a travel agency. And so she, you know, always said, you know, my dad was a work hard. My mom was a follow your dreams. So I think it was a good combination.
Great. What happened? You left Florida to go where?
Left Florida, and then I went to, after college, I went out to California, UCLA, and got my business degree because my dad wanted me to get a law degree, mm-hmm. So I figured I better do the business degree first. Yeah. Realized it was important to have the law degree, and so I did that. It was dreadful. I really was not very good at being an attorney, so I soon realized that I think the lowest day was one day I had ate 19 Snickers bars in the middle of one of my days as a practicing lawyer, and I thought, you know what? I think I need a new job. So from there, I went and I ran Governor Wilson's California office for 4 years or so. And then a lot of the high-tech CEOs and venture capitalists knew me, and they said, you know what? We're having a lot of issues here. We have a lot of lawsuits. People are suing us for reasons that really are unfair. Will you help us create this organization?
How did you make the transition from law school to politics, working in the governor's office?
Well, you know, what I really, really liked about going into the governor's office was you started to look for solutions to problems rather than problems. When I was practicing law, I think I was a little bit more focused in on just focusing on the problems. And so when I went into government and I went to the governor's office, it was my responsibility now to find solutions to the everyday problems that were confronting me.
What happened after that experience?
When I was in the governor's office, about that time after I was there about 4 years, Silicon Valley really started to expand. And so I worked with a lot of the founders of Google, the founders of HP, a lot of those really key early CEO minds asked me to create TechNet.
What was that experience like for you?
It was like drinking water from a fire hydrant. I mean, it was crazy. I left a really secure, great, cushy job in the governor's office to start this new organization. And I remember one of the venture capitalists, after I had just left, I was a single mom, after I just left this secure job, I said, yeah, you know, this may actually even work. I'm thinking, may work? I hope so. I just left my job. So anyway, it ended up being an exhilarating, fabulous experience, but a little more risky than I thought it was going to be.
Exactly. So what was a single mom thinking in order to take that kind of a risk?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't thinking too hard. I mean, in retrospect, you have to say, look at the people you were working with, right? You know, and so that was, they had a very strong success rate. But it was very, very risky in retrospect. I'm thrilled I did it, but if I had really given it much thought, I perhaps wouldn't have done it.
What did you learn from that experience, starting your own business, starting from scratch?
It's all about networking. It's all about relationships, collaboration, really building a great team because you can't do it by yourself. And so once you realize the importance and how powerful building this network can be, we were so much stronger when we left. As I mentioned, we were 250 high-tech CEOs. Well, that's a lot stronger than just me going up to Washington, D.C. and trying to advocate. So really the power of partnerships, the power of collaboration was what I learned.
So now you're running a pretty good-sized organization.
Yes.
Where did you learn to lead?
I'd have to say early on, I was always, you know, a leader in, you know, in whether it's high school or college. But no question, the Silicon Valley experience taught me the most. I mean, these executives built industries in a matter of a couple of months, not companies, but industries. And so to really see this can-do positive attitude and the force of it and the importance of not focusing in on negative things or not focusing in on petty minutia, setting your goals, looking at results, it was really, really left me with a strong, strong impact. Very different, I have to say, from many of my government experiences.
Right. What's the toughest thing you've ever had to accomplish?
Probably being a single mom working in the White House and trying to really balance that. You know, I missed a lot of very fancy dinners and meetings, and you know what? They didn't miss me, so it ended up being absolutely fine. I mean, the love of my life is my, you know, 19-year-old daughter, and just having that, raising her and working as a single mom in the White House was challenging.
Well, you said something surprising to me, though, in the green room about how embracing they were of your time.
Well, I was shocked, actually, when I was at the White House and when I left and I had my, you know, exit interview, if you will, and I said I was so appreciative of the flexibility that the White House gave me that I really didn't feel like I had to, you know, leave. Yes, my daughter, I'm sure, ate more mac and cheese than most kids during that time, but I really didn't feel like I was sacrificing being a great mom or doing the job. Sometimes you just, you know, you worked at 3 a.m. at home on your, you know, computer with no makeup on and your hair on your top of your head, but it worked. As long as you focused in on the results and got the job done, it worked.
How about your proudest moment?
It still is my daughter being a mom, I have to say.
Yeah. How about your professional proudest moment?
Well, I've loved being able to open up and go to China and open up the market, trying to open up the market for our companies. It's exciting right now. We're a global industry, so whether it's Brazil or some of these other emerging countries, really taking the lead and trying to let our companies innovate and grow in those countries is the most exciting for me.
What kind of legacy would you like to be known for as president of this organization?
Well, that I was able to break down barriers globally and enable our companies to innovate.
Great. What's the website address, Leslie?
www.personalcarecouncil.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Leslie Westing, the president and CEO of the Personal Care Products Council. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, for more information about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Lisa Norell.
And Lisa, who are you with?
My company is Energize Growth.
Tell us about Energize Growth.
Mike, we help business-to-business companies grow market share by growing employee and customer mind share. We're celebrating our 10-year anniversary, and over those 10 years, companies like Adobe Systems, Microsoft, and Wells Fargo have implemented our tools and systems.
But you're here to talk about something else today, actually a very special event on March 22nd.
Yes. On March 22nd, I will be the featured speaker and author at the Tower Club. And it's from 8 to 9:30 in the morning. My session is called Four Strategies to Energize Growth and Thrive in the Recovery. And I'm inviting listeners to check it out and join us.
Why is the topic important for people to come and listen?
Well, in the past, Mike, your company could survive with a pulse, but today you can only thrive if you have a plan, especially a customer-focused plan that is really, really focused on helping you build a solid marketing platform for growth.
Who should attend this event?
These are business-to-business companies who are growing and are probably successful, but you know, they may have hit that wall and said, we're not sure how to scale the next wall of growth. We need some fresh ideas, so we're going to have three key things we're going to make sure that people walk away with. Number one, fresh new marketing ideas. Two, capitalizing on hidden opportunities. And three, foster innovative thinking with customers' involvement.
What's the web address, please, Lisa?
They can register for the session by calling Kelsey at the Tower Club, which is area code 703-761-4250. Or you can go to my website, energizegrowth.com, and just contact me, and I'll send you the details.
We've been speaking with Lisa Norell of Energize Growth, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we're happy to welcome Neil Albert, the Vice Chairman of the Board for a company called MCR. Welcome back, Neil. What is MCR?
MCR is a professional services firm that supports the government in project management. We help our customers try to bring in their programs on time and within budget.
And how old is the company?
The company is 35 years this year.
Since 1977.
Since 1977.
Well, congratulations. And how big or small is the company today?
We are about 700 people, about $150 million in revenue.
When did you join the firm?
1988.
In what capacity?
I started out as a cost analyst with MCR and opened up their Boston office. I was the first person in the office in Boston.
So you started out as a cost analyst, yes. And now you're the vice chairman of the board. That's a hell of a trajectory.
Well, and was president and CEO in between all of that. So,
so talk us through a little bit about the sequence.
Well, I started out as an analyst, and as I started to grow the business and get more work in the Boston area, the person who owned the company at the time had decided that I was doing very well and asked me to move to Washington, D.C., and run the business in the Washington, D.C. area as well. So I had both the Boston and D.C. market. And as time went along, I started to grow and was responsible for the entire East Coast of MCR. And by that time, had the largest revenue for the company out of all the divisions that we had.
Was becoming president and CEO something you wanted to do
all along? Actually, I started out wanting just to be the vice president of the company. I never expected to be president or CEO, but I was very pleased to have that opportunity.
What do you think the owner saw in you to give you that position?
I think two things. One is that I was able to make a difference in terms of building the business and could make a difference in selling what we were offering. But the second thing was that I challenged him a lot. I think he liked that. It was always when he wanted to do something, I'd always say, no, you probably really want to do this. And maybe it ended up his way. But I think in the long run, he said, you know what, that's the kind of guy I'd like to see in charge.
So where did that ability to challenge the reality come from?
Well, I think that came from actually growing up in a family. I had two older brothers, much older, mm-hmm. and I was kind of an only child. And so I always challenged my parents because I had the opportunity to do that.
And how did they respond in front of all this challenge?
Well, it was a lot of fighting back, but when the day was done, I got what I wanted.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Sioux City, Iowa.
And what was that experience like?
Well, it's a small town. It's a city. At the time, it was one of the larger cities in Iowa, but it was a small town, really, and mm-hmm. Only about 40,000 people. And everybody kind of knew everybody else. You kind of knew everybody in town. My father was a very prominent person in town, and everybody knew him, liked him. He was, you know, everything was like, oh, where's Dave Albert? He's the guy you got to go see. So it was good. I enjoyed
that. What do you suppose his influence on you was?
His influence was really in terms of being persistent and getting the job done. He was the type of person who was always working, trying to make a good living, but not just in the work he did, but also in the community. He was head of the Boy Scouts. He was in the Chamber of Commerce. He was in mm-hmm. all these other associations and spent a lot of time working those and being very successful on all that.
So he was really visible but from the outside, but you watched it from a distance, you were telling us.
Yes. The bad part of that was I didn't see much of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was never home. I'd be in bed before the time he came home, is that kind of situation. So I, as I grew up, I realized that that was something that wasn't a good thing about it. Although he was very successful and I kind of followed in that path, I've tried to follow in that path. Being with family and being with your family is very important too.
How do you suppose that shaped you as the CEO?
Well, I think for one, it made me obviously care more about what the people in our company are all about and the importance that they should have in a work-life balance.
How did that turn out to be a good decision, business decision?
Well, because as a government services contractor in particular, what we sell is people. We don't sell product. We don't sell computers. We don't sell anything like that. We sell people, and that's what you buy. And the people are what make a difference. And if you treat them well, they'll treat you well.
Hmm. So did you have an education in business?
Yes, I went to George Washington University, and I had my major was in finance and a minor in economics.
How did you get from Sioux City, Iowa to George Washington University?
I actually went to a private school in Colorado and for high school. And that was a great experience for me. I had the opportunity to take on a lot of leadership roles there. I was on the student council. I was head of the basketball team, things like that. And the more I did, the more I realized, I wanted to do something important. I actually wanted to go to George Washington University because I wanted to be a lawyer. Or fortunately, actually, at the time, that was probably the right move, is to be in the business area.
So tell us about those experiences in high school where you found yourself in leadership roles. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I think that, for one of the things I did is I liked all the students. I liked the friends I had and so forth. And I felt that if I had the opportunity to kind of take a leadership role and help them get their dreams and activities that they wanted to do for the school in place, then I would have accomplished something. And I was, there are cliques in every school, but I was kind of a friend of everybody. I kind of felt that that was important. And so as a result, I think I was able to not only help them get their activities that the school was willing to do, but also their friendship and everything made a big difference to me.
Talk about some of the early days when you were made president of the company. What were some of the challenges that you faced?
Well, I was made president of the company when the company was sold to AT&T in about the 1999-2000 timeframe. The challenge there was just to keep people on board in the company. Being part of AT&T was kind of an unusual circumstance. They don't do professional services work for the government. They do sell product. They sell telephones and so forth.
Right.
And so it was a challenge to kind of keep my folks on board, but also to keep our customers aware of who we are and what we do.
How big was the company when you became president?
We were about 28 million at the time, and about 200 employees.
And I believe in the green room you said you're now at 150 million?
150, yes.
And 700 employees.
Correct.
That's some substantial growth.
Yeah, and most of that was in the last 5 years of the company. In this last 5 years, we've had most of that growth. Some of it's due to acquisition, a lot of it's due to the organic growth that we've been able to do in selling our services to the government.
And recently, you've kind of shifted your focus in the company and have become the vice chairman of the board. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Why?
Well, I think for the most part, we felt that the company needed to go in a direction where the day-to-day job was being done by people who could be there day-to-day. And from my perspective, I really wanted to make the company more visible in the community. Mm-hmm. And from that, I think they could do that better as a member of the board. So I'm, meeting with other CEOs. I'm working on various other boards. I'm a member of the Defense Business Board, which is reports to the Secretary of Defense, and other activities. So from that perspective, I get to be the face of MCR and also help get them more visible in what we do.
Why is that important to you?
Well, for me, it's important because it kind of goes back to my father to some extent. I mean, he was involved in the community and involved in a lot of activities that were going on. And I feel that I didn't have enough chance as president and CEO of the company to do that. I was too involved in our day-to-day activities. Now I think I have that, and I want to give back to the community. It's very important. I want our company to show that they've gotten a lot from this community. They need to pay back some of that we've got.
Talk a little bit more about that. How would the company go about doing that?
Well, one of the things we're doing is we've always given to charities. We've always tried to help the community and things. But, in terms of having golf tournaments and things and inviting people. But I think one of the things that I'm looking for is to have a real, honest-to-goodness corporate responsibility of setting up opportunities for our folks to help people in the community go out on their own and help in the name of MCR. To also provide pro bono services of whatever we need to, but also just to sponsor and to get others to work in various organizations, whether nonprofit or other. Yeah.
Is your father aware of your success?
No, he's not. He passed away in 1982.
I'm sorry to hear that. If I was interviewing him, would he be surprised?
He would be terribly surprised.
Why?
Well, I don't think he ever thought I was going to come of much of anything. He was very proud of my older brother, who did do very well. But I think he just never saw that I was going to make it in life. He always thought, well, look, I was always giving it to him, so he'll never do it on his own. But I have his work ethic. Even better, I have a wonderful family and have been very much attached to
Great.
Them.
What's your proudest moment?
I think my proudest moment is really the opportunity to have a family that my 14-year-old daughter, Eliza, I think is probably my proudest moment. She is a really important part of my life, and to have that family and to have her means an awful lot to me.
Great. What's the website address now?
www.mcri.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Neil Albert, who's the vice chairman of the board for a company called MCR. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is...
My name is Paul Smith.
And Paul, who are you with?
I am a benefits consultant with the Potomac Companies.
What does the Potomac Companies do?
Well, we help our client partners control the future costs of their health care.
What do you mean by future costs?
Well, you know, as time, every business executive, one of their top functions in any company as either an owner or a top executive is to control costs at their company. Well, healthcare is no different. You have to look at these things. You have to do things to control these costs.
Yeah. Well, why are you guys so good at doing it?
Well, what we've done and what our clients have been telling us is as we look at the trends over a 5 to 7 year period, a given company might see their rates doubling. And what a lot of executives don't realize is that doubling, if they're, let's say they're paying $1 million a year for premium, goes to $2 million, but they're going to spend $3.5 million to get there. So it's not just a linear thing, it's more of a exponential thing.
I hear many business owners say that rising healthcare costs are a fait accompli. There's just nothing they can do about it. Is that true?
Well, that's why they'd want to work with us and find out. There are things that can be done. There's a lot of things that you have to do. There's a lot of information out there, and that's what we help them do.
In just a few words, is there a success story that you can share with us?
Well, it's an ongoing thing. It's savings over time. There's nothing that anyone's going to do as a shotgun approach and go bang and drop your rates significantly and keep them there. It's what are you doing? How are you monitoring? How are you looking at everything?
If someone wanted to contact you and learn more, what would they do?
www.potomacco.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Paul Smith. Paul's with the Potomac Companies. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Rob Williams, who's the founder and president of a company called Clear Government Solutions. What is Clear Government Solutions, Rob?
Well, Clear Government Solutions is what is known as a CSP, or a cloud service provider.
What exactly is a cloud service provider?
We provide information technology resources to the federal government, in particular, as a utility. Think of the way you buy power, water, you don't pay for the pipes, you don't pay for the reservoir, you pay only for what comes out of the into the spigot. Well, the government has decided to do the same thing for information technology. Rather than owning data centers and buying new computers year in and year out and licenses for things year in and year out, to simply acquire these needed resources on a pay-by-the-drink basis.
Right.
It's a migration from CapEx to OpEx.
Right. Sounds like a great idea. When was the company founded?
Clear was founded 6 years ago.
Uh-huh. How big or small are you today?
We're about 50 employees.
Mm-hmm.
And poised for explosive growth.
So you told us in the green room this isn't your first swing at the bat here. This is actually, you've led several companies. Why, and you've been very successful at it, why get back in the game?
Well, first of all, I really enjoy what I do. When I retired, I lived out in the country, and as I say, can only mend the fence in the South 40 so many times. So I was looking to stay vigorous, stay involved. I loved working with the federal government. It's something that I knew. So I went looking for an opportunity to reengage.
Right. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles. 1949,
mm-hmm.
and grew up in the inner city, a community called Watts. I was, 14 or 15, maybe, 15, I think, at the time of the Watts riots.
As a 14 or 15-year-old, what do you recall? How were you impressed by that incident?
It was frightening. And exciting.
Well, tell us about it. I mean, it must have been something to see as 14.
It was a complete shock. I literally saw some smoke on the horizon and knew that there was something major going on, and was sent home from a part-time job. And got home, and by the time I got home, there was a full-fledged riot going on.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother wouldn't let me out of the house. I sort of experienced it on television the first day or so, although in the ensuing days I got to know the guys in the tank on my front lawn. So,
wow. So growing up in an environment like that has to be challenging. How come you got through it the way you did?
My mother, teachers who were interested in me.
What do you think they saw in you?
Well, I always enjoyed learning new things. So it was partly me being curious, largely them,
mm-hmm.
looking to find kids that they could have an impact with.
Mm-hmm. And because they could have an impact with you, that probably opened doors for you. Tell us about one.
Well, it certainly opened doors for me. While in high school, I went to something called Boys State. And this was a thing held in the state capitol with delegates from schools all over the state. And I was elected by acclamation. To be party chairman, and then organized a victorious campaign for our party. I've always enjoyed public speaking, and those are the kinds of opportunities that came my way, opportunities to be involved in a program called Upward Bound. When I was still in high school,
right.
I was an undergrad at UCLA then, and later, it opened doors for me. I was brought into a program called TYP at Yale University.
Right. So you were telling us you tested very high on the SATs, and you were fortunate enough to get accepted into Yale. Is that correct?
I was very blessed to have good SAT scores.
Right. And you were there for 2 years when something happened. Tell us about that.
My mother had a stroke.
Yeah.
And I was an adopted child, only child. And so I had to go back to California to try and care for my mother.
Yeah.
And so I transferred to UCLA at that time. You transfer from a semester system to a quarter system. The draft board called that a break in my education, which was an automatic revocation of your 2S deferment. And in early 1969, I was inducted into the armed services.
Right. So, you told us that wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
Actually, it was a seminal event in my life.
In what way?
I spent almost the next 10 years on active duty. I'm a Vietnam veteran. But most importantly, I got a chance to see the world, to meet people from every background and every culture, work in environments that really required me to use my brain to excel, and provide performance that was consistent. So it taught me to responsibility. I think more than anything else.
You told us you came away from that experience of being disrupted from a college life, having to care from your mom. You said something that's really quite remarkable. You said one's circumstances should not be one's limitations.
Absolutely, absolutely. Growing up in the inner city as an adopted child in an environment where I would say that education wasn't available or valued by a lot of folk, not everyone, but by a lot of folk, my life could have gone in a lot of directions.
Right.
And again, through guidance in school, through church, through the village that was my particular community, I was kept on the straight and narrow. And I think that at a point, I took some responsibility for that myself to try and make something better of myself.
So how do you suppose all of that experience shaped you as a leader?
Well, it taught me and helped me to understand that you're responsible yourself for what you achieve, and that leadership is a little bit more than merely being the guy in charge. I've been one of these people where I've always tried to be in the forefront of what I'm doing, but true leadership is something more than just having the authority to make things happen. It's the responsibility and to make things happen. You know, the infantry motto is follow me.
Right.
And that's what I've tried to do throughout my life.
Tell us a little bit about how you transitioned from military life to, I guess, getting to where you are now, where, you know, you're a CEO of a corporation. Tell us about your first job experience coming out of the military.
Sure. Well, I'm not a CEO, just to be clear. But the first job experience was happened the very day that I separated from active duty. I was on my way home in uniform. After just out processing, had all my out processing documents right next to me, and drove past a building with a now hiring sign out front. And a mile and a half past it, I realized that I was unemployed and turned around and went back and went in, filled out an application, and they told me they'd interview me right away. The interviewer, it turned out, had a similar background to mine. He had been part of the Army Security Agency and a Russian linguist, and I was just separating from the Army Security Agency and had been trained as an Army linguist, so my interview was in Russian. He saw it on my resume, and we went back and forth in conversational Russian for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the conversation, he said, "You're hired." And I said, "That's great. In what capacity?" And I was told that I was going to be in charge of international recruiting for a company building our largest base in Saudi Arabia.
Is your mom aware of your success? I guess she passed away a while back.
She was aware of my success to a point. She was very proud of me.
Yeah.
And
if I was interviewing her right now, what would she say about you?
She would certainly say that she was proud of me, without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And she would say that...
What would you like to say to your mom for all that strict upbringing?
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I can't thank her enough.
Great.
And I just wish I could have done more for her.
Right.
Late in life.
What's the website address, Rob?
www.cleargovsolutions.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Rob William, who is the founder and president of Clear Government Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, at the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. Joining us today is...
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of John Wyatt, who's the chairman and CEO of a company called Sigital. What is Sigital, John?
Sigital is a company that teaches people how to build secure software. So essentially, to build software that's very difficult for people like organized criminals or foreign governments to hack.
How long has the company been around?
Since 1992.
1992.
Right.
And how big or small are you guys today?
We're about 220 people. Heavily populated by what you would call geeks, I think.
Geeks. Why is this such an important industry today?
So we've become incredibly dependent on software as an industry, and most of that software wasn't built to be secure. So it was built on the assumption that everybody's good. And unfortunately, that's not true anymore. So organized criminals and foreign governments have begun to take that apart, either to steal money or reputations or intellectual property.
When did you join the company?
I joined the company in 2005.
In the role of chairman and CEO?
Originally as president and CEO.
Uh-huh. And why were you the ideal pick? you suppose?
So I've got a good track record of building services companies, particularly services companies that are making significant change to an industry. So I've got a very strong background in software, and I've been very good at hiring the right people and motivating the right people to build a successful services company.
Where did you learn that skill?
So I think it goes back to my college experience, actually. I had the opportunity in my third year of college to run the radio station. So the student union actually hired me full-time and paid me for a year to do nothing but run the radio station. So I had a group of 80 volunteers, and we produced 168 hours a week of programming. I had an absolute blast. And I really learned how to harness and channel the energies and imaginations of a group of people to produce something of value. And I had so much fun, I have replicated that experience since.
Where did you go to college?
A little college called the University of New England in northern New South Wales in Australia.
What was your major?
I changed my mind like three or four times. So I went from economics to economic statistics to operations research back to economics again.
So you refer to the 200 very gifted software folks as geeks. What's it like running and managing these kinds of folks that are so gifted and difficult to manage at times?
Well, it's fun because they're bright. So they challenge you and they have an opinion about everything. But it's not that difficult because uniformly they want to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
They want to take the skills that they learn in college and apply them to something useful in society or industry. And so the challenge is being able to channel that and coach them to be effective at delivering that change. So it's not a motivation issue so much as just managing the opportunities so people are successful.
So for you, it's more about the people.
It's absolutely about the people. That's where I get my satisfaction.
Uh-huh. Where do you suppose that originated from?
That's a good question. I've continued to put myself in situations where the thing that I've most enjoyed is watching the growth of the people. So the faster I can make that happen with talented people, the more satisfaction I get. So
You were telling us about your father a little bit. What was he doing back in Australia?
So my father was a human resources executive for a big insurance company. So his focus every day, I guess, was taking care of people.
Right. Do you remember any of that? Do you remember any of that, what he was bringing home and talking about?
Yes. I mean, he would talk about what worked, particularly amongst the executive ranks, what motivated people to be exceptional, and how badly performing some people were and why. So I learned a lot about what motivates people, I guess, from him.
Great. How about Mom?
Well, she was a nurse and a stay-at-home mom. So, again, she was somebody who just got her satisfaction from taking care of people. So,
In what way do you suppose you were influenced by your mom?
So one of the things that she said that stuck with me throughout my life is she strongly encouraged me to get out there and make a difference in the world. And I always look back on that because it's a driver for me.
Uh-huh. Is your mom aware of your success?
Yeah, she was. I mean, I think she was amazed at the rate that that I was able to make things go.
Yeah. Talk about one of the most difficult things you've ever had to accomplish.
There's been quite a few of those. I'm running my fourth company at this point.
Yeah.
Each of the companies that I've run have had some very difficult times in their life. So I guess probably the most difficult time actually that I've experienced was the first time I had to do a layoff.
Oh boy.
And that was after running a company for 12 years. We went through just a very bad patch commercially. The federal government shut down for about 3 weeks. And it's the first time I've had to ask people who were performing well to leave because I couldn't support them. So I guess it's the first time I felt like I'd really screwed up.
What do you think you took away from that experience?
I'm much more careful and much more thoughtful about hiring people. So I make fewer assumptions that everything will go right.
Yeah. You were telling us earlier about an experience you had in the Washington area in the early days of the computer business.
Yeah. The challenge there...
Just to help the audience out, you were selling boxes.
Oh, yes, right. I bought an Entree Computer Center dealership, and the business was going through the roof. It went up to about $10 million within the first 14 months, and we couldn't buy enough IBM PCs. So we went out and bought about $1 million worth of PCs on the gray market. 2 days later, after they hit our warehouse and we'd paid for them, IBM put on two new plants, dropped the price of PCs by 20%. So we now had $1 million worth of PCs that we had paid more for than they were selling retail. So we spent the next 2 years selling the most expensive PCs you've ever seen in your life.
How did you do it?
And we did it by wrapping services and software around them. So we converted them all to solutions.
So would you say you've failed, not often, but enough throughout your career to make you what?
To make me understand that you can overcome just about anything. It's never as bad as it seems.
Yeah.
Nor is it as good.
A lot of folks with that kind of that kind of a bruising,
right,
would stop taking risks, but you didn't. You kept going on.
No, I mean, it was like that'll lose the house.
What were you like as a kid?
I was fairly achievement oriented, quite dedicated, and involved with academics. But I really enjoyed joining different organizations and making things happen. So I've tried just about every organization that was around through schooling or even subsequently.
What's left for you to accomplish, you think?
I'd like to be able to mentor a variety of companies and not just do one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to contribute to government, but I've found that very, very difficult. I've tried it a few different times in my career. And
if you could do it effectively, what would you be doing?
What would I be doing with respect to government?
Yeah.
I would probably work with the welfare programs and try and make them more efficient.
Why is that important to you?
Because it allows people who might not otherwise have a chance to break through and be successful. Mm-hmm. And that's our future.
Yeah. What would you say your proudest moment up till now has been?
My proudest moment was building a company called James Martin & Co. Our mission was to improve the way people built software so you could do it much more reliably and much less expensively. We touched most of the software industry in doing that.
Yeah.
I had about 1,000 people, and we covered most of the Western world in just teaching people how to build software better.
What's next for the company you're leading now?
Our mission now is to change the way people build software. So I'm following a very similar footprint. And so our objective is to really roll out those techniques for building software across Western Europe and North America so that you can depend on software when it arrives and not be worried that people will steal your personal information or your cash or your secrets.
Great. What's the website address, John?
Cigital, that's CIGITAL.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with John Wyatt, who's the chairman and CEO of a company called Cigital, Inc. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Dixon, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show, including Leslie Westheen, who's the president and CEO of Personal Care Products Council, Neil Albert, the vice chairman of MCR, Rob Williams, the founder and president of Clear Government Solutions, and finally John Wyatt, who is the chairman and CEO of a company called Cigital, Inc. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio.